rätselhafte Todesfälle, naturwissenschaftlicher Tiefgang und Empfehlungen, wie Sie den Alltag möglichst unbeschädigt überleben. Hallo, hier spricht Florian Klenk und am Freitag, den 26. April 2024, läuft die dritte Staffel von Klenk und Reiter, dem Falter-Podcast aus der Gerichtsmedizin. Christian Reiter und ich kredenzen Ihnen jeden Freitag einen neuen Fall. Sie finden uns auf falter.at/Gerichtsmedizin und überall dort, wo es Podcasts gibt.
Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen, meine Damen und Herren, im Falter Radio. Es sind entscheidende Wochen für Amerika bis zum Wahltag am 3. November. Donald Trump setzt alles auf eine Karte, um das Ruder doch noch herumzureißen, in einem Wahlkampf, in dem er immer mehr an Boden verliert. Die unabhängigen Medien werden in den USA oft etwas übertrieben als vierte Gewalt der Demokratie bezeichnet. Trump hetzt gegen Journalisten als Volksfeinde, wenn sie seine Propaganda nicht übernehmen. Es ist eine beispiellose Auseinandersetzung um die Zukunft der liberalen Demokratie, die sich vor unseren Augen abspielt in den USA, mit Auswirkungen für Europa und den Rest der Welt. Die britische Reporterin Alison Smale war viele Jahre führende Journalistin der New York Times, dem wichtigsten liberalen Medium des Landes. Sie hat als Chefreporterin aus Europa berichtet, war Außenpolitikchefin in New York und Chefredakteurin der International Herald Tribune. Im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum in Wien sprach Alison Smale über die aktuellen Herausforderungen für den unabhängigen Journalismus unter Trump, aber auch in Europa. Das Gespräch in englischer Sprache mit der langjährigen internationalen Spitzenjournalistin führte Tessa Schischkowitz.
We were thinking maybe to start with the new center of darkness for the press and the media, which is the White House. And with a president who is now fighting for his re-election by tweeting frantically, although he currently has COVID. Yes. And so I would like to start asking you, Alison, how you, as a longtime member of the New York Times editorial office, have seen this unprecedented deterioration between an administration, a White House, and the so-called established liberal media in the United States.
Just a small topic like that.
Just like this.
Thank you, Tessa, for such a warm and generous introduction, and thank you very much for inviting me to come here. It's really wonderful to be back in these rooms again, which I've only seen once before, so thank you. Basically, I think you want to know how we got to this state where relations between the media and the White House have deteriorated sharply. I think it's clear that this is something that results from the extraordinary occupant of the White House. We all knew when Donald Trump unexpectedly won the election in 2016 that we would probably be in for something pretty unusual. I'm not sure that any of us guessed at the scope. And I think what we will now be spending some time doing is trying to assess, in the light of whether Trump wins a second term or he doesn't, what occurred during the first term and how has it affected both international and national politics. I think it's very clear that the current occupant of the White House is a man with a very large sense of himself, and we see somebody who is, self-centered and even more so than most political leaders. Certainly, all sorts of things have been unusual, and here we are in a situation which sums up pretty much how unusual that is, and that is that the White House, the incumbent at the White House, is fighting now the campaign whilst he is also ailing with a potentially deadly disease, which we certainly hope he and others do not succumb to. But it is definitely a point where it means he's communicating, as you say, via tweets, via snatches of broadcasts with friendly powers. And this is very much different from the traditional role that we would see in the last weeks of a US presidential campaign. I think that it's going to probably be one that historians chew over for the ages. But for the moment, our main job is to get out there and report what is happening day by day and trying to make sure that people understand the magnitude of the choice that they have, if I can say that slightly sort of patronizing way, which isn't intended to be patronizing.
But this is the big problem also. I mean, there is such an abyss between the administration and most media now that is not in support of Trump. And these two camps look at each other, and it's practically, it has become impossible to even talk to each other. I mean, your publisher, Mr. Sulzberger, said recently that Trump was putting lives at risk by his politics, by his presidency. Is that even, after something, if somebody talks like this to each other, can you then still report on an administration at all?
I mean, I think it's a very good question. I think, as I say, we have to be true to ourselves. We have to make sure that we are conveying the depth of the difference between this and other situations in the past. So I think it's also should be noted that relations between the White House and the media press corps have been on a long deterioration. And it was not actually when Trump was elected, it was a shock. But there were plenty of reporters who had experience of covering him in the past, most particularly Maggie Haberman, who worked for New York tabloids and covered Trump in that incarnation. And that gave her more access to the president when he was first elected. I think now, I honestly don't know what the situation is, but I think we can judge by the paucity of interviews between Trump and anybody who is likely to oppose him to say that he has, narrowed the field upon which you can have this debate. I think that's a pity for democracy, and it is a pity if it becomes an example that others might copy. But what we really have to do is to concentrate on the last weeks of the campaign now and see that we try to bring off something that still can be declared an exercise in democracy.
I mean, one of the terms that he came up with very early in his administration was to call everything fake news, which he didn't like. I mean, that set the tone, didn't it?
Well, I think basically the fake news thing sort of traced a path out of this little town Velesh in Macedonia, where people were posting in the guise of being people on genuine voters and creating a whole string of Facebook posts that suggested that there were people ready to vote for Trump where there perhaps weren't. So the fake news term did not actually, I think, originate with Trump, but it was something that he took up. And I just think that we have to be very careful in using language anyway. I mean, this is what we have to define our actions, make them different from those of animals. And we really care about, if we care about language, just look at the phrase fake news. If it's fake, it really can't be news, and if it's news, it can't be fake. So I think it's very important not to take up every phrase that is tossed out in this process, and that's a big one of them. We will hurt ourselves more than anybody else if that's how we come to view the whole process. So, I mean, I think Donald Trump adopted even fake news awards, but I think even he had slight tongue-in-cheek when he spoke of these.
Well, you never know exactly what he takes serious or what not.
True.
But if you think that when it was announced that he tested positive with COVID and you had a look at Twitter and you realized that immediately there was a complete, in all camps, there was conspiracy theories were spilling out all over. And my first thought was like, okay, he just wants to get out of the next TV debate or something like that. The fact that we all entertained these thoughts also, I think, shows how far the trust in what we're being told by this administration has eroded.
Yes, I mean, eroding trust, I think, is basically the motto that you could hang over all of to describe events that have unfurled over the last 3 to 4 years. And it will be very interesting to see if it's possible to, I don't think it's possible to return to the status quo ante, no matter what the outcome is, because a lot of very tough things have been said by a lot of people in different camps. And it is, you know, a discourse that has therefore opened up a separate line of questioning, which is what is democracy and how do we return to an agreed vision of what that is? I'm not so sure it'll be easy.
In terms of media responsibility, do you think that the so-called liberal media made a mistake to, you know, pick up the provocation so easily?
Well, I don't know. I think you have to report what you see, and that is what there was to say. Then I think you can have a long debate about the role of the vaunted objectivity of the American press and some other media in other countries. I think it's going to be very hard, as I say, to establish a common basis again. But hopefully there will be a result that allows us all to start doing that. But that's what we don't know.
I mean, it seemed to me that over the last month, suddenly the critical interviews with Donald Trump were not made by the New York Times, who has lost access, but by people in Fox News. There was a certain shift, either because Trump becomes more erratic every day, so that even his own media camp is becoming nervous, mm-hmm. and says, like, you can't just say such utter nonsense live on camera in the middle of an interview. Is it this, or?
I mean, I don't have a sort of secret path into the deliberations of what gets on Fox, but I think there has been something of a change of tone, and probably that reflects deliberations by journalists who, at the end of the day, have to answer to their face in the mirror and a lot of other people for what they do to earn a living. So it is tricky. I think also that certainly since the announcement that President Trump was suffering from COVID, it's not clear to what degree he has consulted with anybody, his doctors, for instance. There's a fly gate.
It's a fly again. So like Pence sent over his last remaining fly. not important. And it moves, not unlike the one of Pence.
Right. So anyway, that's. I just think that it's interesting to observe the change in tone, but who knows what it actually means unless we're round the editorial tables in different media organizations. We can't say, and that's as it should be.
Yeah, I mean, if you see how he's tweeting today that he wants to go back and campaign immediately in Florida and in Pennsylvania because the polls are showing a widening lead, a widening gap between the candidates and a bigger and bigger lead for Joe Biden now, up to 10 to 13%. So clearly the president becomes more and more desperate. But I wonder, one thing that I thought was really interesting in these debates, in this first debate, was how little authority he can take from a moderator, from someone who chairs this debate. Journalists, for him, I think, don't count at all as a professional sort of item, and he doesn't understand that he should actually sort of behave according to some rules.
I really do wonder to what extent it was a purposeful strategy that he appeared with at the first debate, because he really was kind of pacing the stage and barely letting Biden finish a sentence from the very get-go. So it's very hard for all of us to deal with trying to analyze these moves, which are not part of the normal political discourse and not part of what we would regard as logical ways to pursue goals. I think this is another part of the whole issue of the role of media and the fate of democracy, and it goes far beyond the scope of a TV debate, but that debate showed us how difficult it is to have a discourse if somebody shifts the sort of area of the playpen, as it were.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's also that we've seen in the last years, and not only in the States, that spin doctoring and message control has become sort of an established instrument of conveying politics to the people. And these, you know, huge new media departments in ministries and prime ministers' offices, which spit out short messages in Britain, usually three words, like "build back better" is the newest one that we have in the UK now, which are sort of very much controlled and leave little room for debate. And it makes it extraordinarily difficult for traditional media, which is shrinking in size and shrinking in finances, to actually put up this fight against spin-doctored message control politics pouring down on us. How did you see this development in the last years also, if you take the example of Trump and the New York Times?
I mean, I definitely think it's not restricted to Trump and the New York Times, but obviously there is an increasing perception in government circles anyway that you have to ram home your message, and this has been something that has been done by many rulers throughout the centuries and millennia of history, and in the sense that you are going to put all the force you can to try and convince people of your point of view. This is nothing new, but what I think we're all feeling is that because For instance, digital technology allows you to analyze very quickly where is a certain policy resonating, with whom, how old are these people, is anything that about their behavior sort of something that you can extend to other spheres. So I do think it's clear that governments, of course, can summon up resources. They are subject to controls if there's a democratic system and there's some kind of accountability, both in the political system and in the media. I think that we definitely have not seen the death of that. But you're right that traditional media in many countries are not making money. They don't have the resources to throw at these problems. And it is getting harder and harder to get the message across that there might be something fishy here and it's worth investigating. The New York Times, thanks also to a wonderful growth in its digital subscriptions, does have money at its disposal. I'm sure they would not like to think that there's overly much of it, but they are able to undertake the most fantastic investigative efforts. But it's very, very hard to do. You need the backing of owners, and we've seen ownerships change, but for instance, Jeff Bezos taking over at the Washington Post enabled the Washington Post to hire a lot of reporters. And that immediately heightened the competition between the New York Times and the Washington Post, particularly in Washington itself, for getting the story and really uncovering new details. So that is very, very important. But I think it's also up to us to keep an eye on how do we see governments putting out their point of view. And you know, it's not just a phenomenon that, you know, in Eastern Europe, for instance, you might say, but look at what the Poles and the Hungarians are doing. It's actually much more subtle to examine the reasons behind this and how much support or non-support these policies do gain. And you have in Western Europe also efforts to influence the message, of course. I mean, a state government broadcasting institution exists for a purpose, and one of those purposes is to explain or propagate the policies of the particular government. This is not a surprise.
Well, the difference maybe nowadays is that we were used the way we grew up in more or less Western Europe, if we can call Austria part of Western Europe, and you grew up in the UK with a very strong broadcasting corporation that was the model for basically every free media institution in the world. And we were used to having good states. We thought in that part of the world where we grew up that the state exists to help us to preserve our freedom of speech also. This is the problem that suddenly also in the West sometimes we have governments where we think they might put more pressure to limit the freedom of media.
Well, I mean, yes. I don't find it that surprising that this development has occurred. I think one thing that did surprise us all, if we go back to the end of the Cold War and the fall of communism at the end of the 1980s, is that many of us, both here and in the affected countries, thought, this is it, we've done it. The wall fell, our way of thinking prevailed, and therefore the media will be sort of created in the image of that thinking. And that really didn't happen and was probably a mistake, largely to be laid at our door in being sort of slightly naive and not taking an all-encompassing view of what markets would do to media, what the distribution of financial resources would do to media, what the desire would be amongst thinking people to make media work rather than go into business and make money. I was just today recalling an example of one particular East European country where a friend of mine was one of a group of journalists who had taken over their publishing groups, various media, and really improved them and really produced a daily and a weekly that, you know, really sort of spurred debate in the society. It became very successful, so successful that the German group Westdeutsche Allgemeine was interested in acquiring it. And what happened to my friend, who was the only woman involved in this negotiation on the side of the East Europeans, was that she really was against selling, and she wanted it to continue to be reflective of her country. But all the guys who were in the same meeting, they wanted to drive fast cars and make fortunes like their friends who'd gone into business. And so they agreed to the sale of this publication, which, it's not that it became terrible, it just was not no longer the product of that particular country. And I think that was where an awful lot of debate quickly meant that things tended to move as the governments wanted them to, because they wanted to get rich quick. They didn't really understand how important it was to have it fixed as to what you want to say. And so I think that, you know, many things could have turned out differently if there'd been more understanding also in the West, that this was a thoroughly new undertaking and there were no examples that really could be waved in front of former communist countries. I mean, it wasn't as if, I don't know, not everybody was probably would have had the resources to do something like a Financial Times. We did see Hospodarske Noviny make various advances in the Czech Republic. But it's really hard to change things quickly, and especially when there's also this pressure to make a profit, which was a totally unknown way of working in many places in Europe.
But definitely, you know, it goes all together, all the institutions that were developed, and there was young democracies trying to establish free media, but also independent courts, independent political parties, governments that followed sort of the rule of law rather than the rule of, you know, an ideology or the rule of some kind of corrupt mafia gang. And the media, for example, in Poland and in Hungary, which we all watch with horror, is being put under the thumb of the rather authoritarian governments. In Poland, less than in Hungary, but in Poland, the situation is bad enough. And I think if you look at the index of press freedom of Reporters Without Borders, Poland has slipped to the 62nd place, and Hungary is now on the 89th out of 180 countries. And this all happened within the last 10 years, in particular in the last 5 years, that all these hopes of independent free media is being crushed in front of our eyes. And when you were there in 1989, in 1990, 91, with a young Viktor Orban in Hungary gearing up as a young student politician and going into politics with Fidesz. And I remember I was also at the first free elections in Hungary, and he was sitting there, he was speaking, you had the feeling this is the hope. And the hope now seems to be gone. And is it not also because, you know, could the media have put up more of a fight if the politics go so authoritarian?
Well, I think it also depends. You have to watch how this happens. And In Hungary, for instance, the government domination of the media is primarily achieved through control of the advertising revenue. And you can say, well, here's a company that is taking care of that, and there's no particular proof that it serves some nefarious political purpose. And there's no specific proof of somebody in the government pulling strings. So it is a very subtle and difficult thing to say. I mean, we should note that, for instance, in Poland, we talk about the lack of freedom, but the presidential election last year was a very close-run thing. I think it was a well-run democratic exercise, which, you know, one would have to go into minute detail to analyze where did things stray from which vision of democracy. So I really like to not to sort of join easy statements that say what's happening in Hungary and Poland is terrible. I think it bears vigilance, and clearly they have slipped in the standards by the index, applied by the index. But at the same time, I'm not sure that it's really our position to tell or to suggest that we know better what would best suit Hungary and Poland. I mean, vigilance is required and is definitely a good thing. But at the same time, it's very easy to stray into being sort of slightly arrogant and slightly neglectful of other places.
Well, I mean, we have certainly enough problems in our own countries. Clearly, we just had in Austria a government up till the Ibiza gate case where the power of the ORF, of the Austrian television, was immediately under severe attack. An independent anchor man like Armin Wolf and other colleagues were severely attacked and really threatened in being able to do their job correctly. We have it now in the UK since this government took over on the first day, on the 13th of December, the attacks on the BBC started because it was supposedly had underestimated the anger of the people and the country and all sorts of things, which are always the same slogans of populist governments which just don't like critical media. So of course we shouldn't be arrogant and explain to other people, but in general we can see in Hungary that these media outlets are being closed down and brought under control of Viktor Orban, and I think it's our duty to protest against it.
No, it's definitely our duty, and particularly as journalists, to speak out against abuses of the power, the special power that is given to media and to government to mould a message. No question about it. Mm.
I mean, the cases in Poland, as you say, that the government is not very secure, and this is why Jaroslaw Kaczyński now came in this week as Deputy Prime Minister in order to support the Law and Order Party, because he cannot be sure that the majority is stable enough. So for sure, it's, you know, especially in Poland, there's no way that we need to give up the fight, but the question would also be how media in Poland and in Hungary can be supported. I mean, look at the case of Slovakia, where Jan Kuciak was murdered 2 years ago, and even if there were huge protests in the street, first of all, he was dead, and people are very, very scared.
And his fiance was dead.
And his fiance was dead also.
Absolutely nothing to do with this.
And this is like 40 minutes from here, yeah? So I think the responsibility that we all as colleagues also have should be to ask what we can do.
Absolutely, and to be as active as possible, since we have countless examples and we've discussed them here with our opening discussion on Washington, of how things, you know, can go bad pretty easily if we don't speak up.
I mean, what you did in the last 2 years in the United Nations was sort of a very admirable attempt to to modernize the communications department, where you try to in a multinational organization like this, where all these different cultures also of how to communicate, how to send, to represent politics that the UN wants to be shown to the world. So you try to modernize it. How difficult was it? Because this could be also a case model for many other organizations.
Yes, although I think there is nothing quite like the United Nations, also in this sort of tremendous variety of views that it has to, as an institution, balance against each other. And I think we can all be very happy that the UN Food Programme won the Nobel Peace Prize today.
Yeah, apropos.
Something very good to trumpet from the United Nations. And I would say that, you know, I joined in, what was it, 2017, with the idea that Guterres, who had just been chosen as the Secretary General, he was very keen on reforming the institution, and he certainly made that the watchword of his pitch for the job, and his conduct of the job when he was in, now that he's been in office for almost 5 years, not quite. So it was definitely something that he wanted done, and you don't get things done at the United Nations unless you are seen to have the backing of fairly senior people. One thing I did was actually just change the name of the department. You wouldn't believe how many meetings it took to achieve that, but the old name was the Department of Public Information, which just smacked of another era. Something that was about global communications suggests a much more global approach, and communications in themselves are, of course, a two-way process. So it became less like sort of Moses with the tablets coming down from the mountains and saying, thou shalt do this. So I think it was definitely something that was a joy to see when you achieved something. I said all the time at the United Nations that I found it about one third fun, another third fascinating, and another third frustrating. And how things turned out on any given day depended on which mixture of those you were dealing with. But it is an unbelievable institution, and for all the criticism that is directed at it, it has shown itself to be capable of both reform and administrative processes, but also real effects on the ground. I mean, people would starve, more people would starve, if the UN food program was not there.
I also want to ask you, because you are here in Vienna, not thanks to us, but thanks to the Institute for the Wissenschaft von Menschen, the Institute for Human Sciences, where you came here for this year now to work on exactly these questions that we have discussed now, also on media in Eastern Europe and Western Europe. And do you think you can sort of apply some of the lessons you learned also at the UN to these very fragile institutions and media outlets in Eastern Europe? Do you expect to be able to just collect information or also try to influence certain situations, certain...
I think I live to be surprised always, and I'll see what I find as I investigate. But what is important is that people should know that this effort is going on. And I think it's very important not to give up hope. I have a friend, Anne Cooper, who's just completed a very good report on media in Russia. And she had previously been prepared to declare Glasnost pretty much dead. But when she looked a second time in recent months, she came to the conclusion that there were any numbers of examples of journalists in small and less small places in Russia, really taking the authorities to task and applying the rules of free media. So I think it's important that we emphasize what good can be done rather than what kind of mistakes I might think I find. I'm there to help people fix those, but not necessarily as I see it, but as they would have it if they can change the way things are done in their particular country.
Well, I totally agree with you. I mean, when I lived in Russia, we would report every month on one more TV station or newspaper being brought on Kremlin line. And it was always this slogan that you write, the last debate program in NTV or any mm-hmm. other Russian channel has been closed down, or the editor has been fired, and now it will all be on Kremlin line. And that went on for years. I mean, it was always the last program, mm-hmm. and there was still one other one, and others came up, and the courage of colleagues in Russia in particular, but all over Eastern Europe under more and more authoritarian political regimes is astonishing. I mean, it is absolutely astonishing. And yes. as you rightly say, in the regions in Russia, where in cities like Yekaterinburg, of course we never hear about them easily in Western Europe, but yeah. there are very, very courageous colleagues who work tirelessly to work against the corruption of only the city governments and all these kind of things. So for sure, we should never give up hope.
No, definitely not. And let's look at what's happened, for instance, in Khabarovsk, a not well-known city in the far east of Russia. But when the Kremlin and Putin summoned back the popular local governor, people erupted in protest, and they've kept this up for 4 months now, which is not so easy.
Yeah, which is very good. But we also, of course, had just now the case of Alexei Navalny. So if a critic is a little bit too successful, then he might get first harassed, then poisoned, and subsequently shot. So for him to go back to Russia now, of course, is a high risk of life operation.
Yes, and we shall see how the whole case develops. But what I think is interesting to note, for instance, in the Navalny episode, is that one of the sort of perhaps slightly unsung heroes of the episode is the pilot who decided to land the plane once it was discovered that Navalny was sick. Had he flown straight on to Moscow, maybe something worse would have occurred.
Well, it's also interesting to see how this operation was planned, because while he was in the air, flown back to Moscow, and he was supposed to die in the air, there was also no opportunity for people to tweet, to shoot videos. It then went immediately out into the world because they were in the air. So it's also a sign how his own video and social media campaigns that were so successful and have helped him to reach so many millions of young Russians probably made people who tried to kill him think how he can be taken out of operation without being even able to tell the world about it for about 2 hours until they would have landed in Moscow.
I wouldn't presume to kind of second guess what was going through minds in and associated with the Kremlin, but it's clearly an instructive episode in terms of to what lengths are people prepared to go.
Yeah. I mean, if you look over 30 years of reporting, when you started, there was no, you know, internet was just in its infancy, and we didn't have mobile phones. We disappeared somewhere for mm-hmm. a day and tried to find a story. We didn't have help where we Googled in 1 second what the name of the president of the local country where we just ended up was because we couldn't. So how do you think it helped us, journalists and reporters in the field, to be so well connected, or is it also the danger that that we are not needed anymore because everyone on the street can take a video and send it around?
Well, I mean, I think we definitely are needed. I think we're more needed than ever. where needed to analyze events, where needed to present the points of view that we think we come across, not just for readers, but for a general, not just for specific readers, but for a general audience. And very much that by disappearing for long times away from editors, always the enemy of reporters, it was possible for us to kind of turn up new facts and change people's minds about things. I think it was valuable, but I think basically one of the sort of principal values of media is that you have feisty reporters who are pushing hard for their story to get more attention, and you have editors who are safekeeping. Have we really done due diligence on the truth of this? And I think that it doesn't matter whether that happened in an age where we could disappear for a day, nobody could reach us, hallelujah. Whereas now we're reachable all the time, but we have the same obligation to push back if somebody is trying to drive us into a line of argument or reporting that we don't think is valuable. So I think it's absolutely the same process as it ever was, which is, you know, good reporter goes out, tries to find story, comes back with good story, and tries to persuade editors to run it. Editors are skeptical, and the collective effort is a good one. It's a super result.
Das war die langjährige Spitzenjournalistin der New York Times, Alison Smale, im Gespräch mit Tessa Šišković im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum in Wien. Beim Bruno-Kreisky-Forum, das auch in den schwierigen Zeiten der Pandemie spannende Themen mit hochrangigen Gästen präsentiert, bedanke ich mich sehr herzlich für die Zusammenarbeit. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Der Falter bietet als Wiener Wochenzeitung auch internationale Reportagen und Analysen. Ein Abonnement zahlt sich aus. Ein Falter-Abo kann man auch im Internet bestellen über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Anna Goldenberg und Miriam Hübel betreuen die Falter-Technik. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.